Today, I'm sharing an interview between my daughter, Crystal Hurst, and Kay Warren. Kay is the wife of Pastor Rick Warren of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California. In April of 2013, Rick and Kay Warren were forever changed when their youngest child, Matthew, committed suicide. For over a year, they shed tears daily. Kay shares how traumatic it was to not only grieve the loss of her son, but to also see him suffering with mental illness for the majority of his life. In this heart-gripping conversation, Kay encourages us to choose joy when happiness isn't enough. Allowing herself to feel joy is a decision Kay has had to make over and over again. Kay has learned that choosing joy is honoring to her late son Matthew and to her Heavenly Father as well. The challenge of your current season may not include loss. However, what Kay has shared will help you and me believe that life can be good again. Joy is available, even in challenging seasons, for you and me.
Well, I am so honored today to have Ms. Kay Warren joining me on today's show. Thank you so much for being with me, Ms. Kay. I'm excited to have you here.
Thank you so much, Crystal. It's great to be with you.
Well, the reason I'm doing this series of podcasts is because I wanted to give other women an opportunity with other types of stories to share their journeys so that women can be encouraged. And one of the main things that I've heard over and over and over again from women who are who comment online or who send me emails or who respond to the podcast that I do is that they are lost because of grief. They are lost because they've lost a spouse, a parent, a sibling, a friend, a child, and are having a really, really hard time getting back to their life, getting back to what it means to honor their girl because they're so there's such a struggle with the grief process itself. And I know that you have had a journey through grief, and I figured that you'd be able to share a little bit of your story to help others. So if you don't mind, for those who may not know, would you just share a little bit of your story with us?
Yeah. Our youngest son, Matthew, we lost him on April 5th, 2013. He took his life. He had lived with mental illness almost all of his life. He's the youngest of my three kids, and so when he was a toddler, I knew he was different than his older brother and sister, but I didn't know that children could have a mental illness. I didn't know, for instance, he was diagnosed when he was 7 with depression, but and could have been diagnosed sooner than that, but I just didn't know children could have a mental illness. It just never occurred to me that the differences and the different behavior, different responses that he gave to life, it just never occurred to me that it could be because of that. I just thought he was developing in his own way, or he would grow out of it, or yes, there were things that concerned me, but mental illness just never crossed my mind. And from the time he was diagnosed with depression, it just feels like his whole life was a series of mental health diagnoses. You know, I'm not saying they were all accurate, but he was given the diagnoses, you know, of depression, of ADHD, panic disorder, early onset bipolar, suicidal ideation when he was 12, major depression, OCD, body dysmorphic disorder, borderline personality disorder was the last diagnosis he got probably a year and a half before he died. So, I mean, his entire life was consumed with illness, with struggle, with suffering, with torture, really, emotional torture. And it just was so hard to watch my little boy suffer in such profound ways. I mean, it's hard enough for adults to live with a mental illness, but for a child and have it affect your entire life, it was so hard. It was so, so hard. And as he got older, he, of course, was an adult and could control the help that he sought for his illness. And there were periods of time in which he took medication and stayed on it and went to therapy and did the things that would, you know, help him manage. And then there were other periods of time in which the illness predominated, and he would think, I don't need to be on this medication. I don't like the way it makes me feel. It's not helping. And he would go off and stop therapy. And, you know, it just, we just say he hit that brick wall, that immovable brick wall of mental illness for the last time on April 5th, 2013. And he took his life. And it is, you know, I mean, I'll say more as we go along, but sure. Just to sum that up, that has been, this kind of grief has been the hardest thing I've ever done. This grief is the hardest work I've ever done. It left us completely devastated and yet not destroyed. We determined that we were going to accept that, yes, we were devastated, but we also were not going to let ourselves be completely devastated, destroyed by this loss. And so the last 4.5 years have been a journey of learning how to live again and how to keep standing, sort of like what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for just backing up a little bit and explaining to us, or to those who may not know already, what the story is behind your story of grief. And I have to be honest and just stop right here and ask you a question. I have 5 kids, so they're aged 25 to 8. And so I know that kids go through a lot of different seasons, right? They have seasons where they just seem to be on cloud 9, and then they have seasons, particularly during adolescence and their teenage years, when they seem to struggle emotionally. And so as a parent, you worry a lot. You try not to. You try to be anxious for nothing, as the Bible says, and you try to lay all of your concerns at the Lord's feet. But you do. You look at your kids and you think, are they going to be okay? And so I just want to ask you, how does somebody know the difference between normal childhood development and concern about mental illness or something else that they need to check on?
Such a great question. And people do ask me that all the time. And so half of all mental illness, you start seeing the signs by the age of 14. Half of all mental illness shows up by the age of 14, and 75% by about age 24. So it is something that can start young and often starts in those teenage years, or starts to be more noticeable. And I think some of the signs are particularly when younger kids, when they don't really have the language to tell you what they're thinking or feeling. Matthew just started using the word, I'm sad. You know, I'm sad. And he came home from school. This was at 7. When people lose interest in the things that have previously given them pleasure, you know, maybe they lose interest in school. They lose interest in playing with their friends. They lose interest in a hobby. They lose interest in a sport. They might sleep too much or sleep too little. They might become irritable or aggressive or withdrawn, can kind of be the opposite, withdrawn. As it starts into teenage years, there could be maybe drug use or alcohol use or overspending or, breaking the rules, breaking the curfews, And it's not that any one of those things by themselves is necessarily a warning sign. Mm-hmm. It's when maybe several of those things start coming together over a period of time. If somebody comes home from school, your teenager comes home from school and they failed a test at school. Well, most kids are going to feel bad about that. Yeah. So that's not like, oh no, I've got to be careful. But you need to start paying attention when several of those things happen, and they happen over a period of weeks or months. If it doesn't shift, if those behaviors are different than the way this child has been before, and it's continuing over a period of, a month, 6 weeks, you should at least talk to their pediatrician. Okay. You should start with the pediatrician, talk to them, have your child evaluated, because kids do suffer with mental illness. And that's the bad news. But the good news is that with treatment and intervention and attention to the issues, and parents really paying attention and staying on top of it and seeking help for their kids, kids do well. They do well. So it's, again, it's those kind of things over a period of time and they don't go away and it's a change, that's when you start, you need to start paying attention to it. Yeah. There's a great website called NAMI, and it's NAMI.org.
Okay.
National okay. Alliance on Mental Illness. And it is a great website because it's just full of understandable information, gives you all sorts of, you know, lists of things to look at, what to do, where to get help. I can't recommend that website enough, NAMI.org.
Okay, great. I'll be sure and put a link to that website in our show notes, because I know that some parents are listening and going, okay, I may need to check up on this, and I want to be as proactive as possible. And so,
well, it's a really logical, it's a logical question is, you know, if it happened to your kid, could it happen to mine? And mm-hmm. the answer is yes, it could.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks for giving us that background, to your story. Just switching gears a little bit, let me tell you a little, about my experience with grief and why I think this is such a crucial thing for us to talk about. My mom, lost both parents. She lost both parents over the last 10 years. And so 10 years ago, my grandfather passed away. And just 3 years ago now, my grandmother passed away. And I will tell you that the way my mother has handled her grief has differed a little bit. The first time when she lost a parent, when my grandfather died, she, a few months later, I think maybe about a year later, she went to the doctor and just was asking him about all these different things that were going on with her. And, you know, he stepped back and he said, you know what? I think you're still grieving. I think you're still grieving. And I think you just need to give yourself the space and the time to grieve. Your body is telling you that you are still in a very emotional place and you need to respond to that. And so, you know, you would think, or a lot of people think, okay, after a year.
That's not very long.
After a year, you ought to be good. And I don't know if it was a year or 6 months or 18 months, but I do know that it was a period of time in which, based on our culture, we would think somebody ought to be okay. And so when my grandmother passed away, my mother just deliberately said, you know what? I'm giving myself a pass. I'm giving myself a pass to not be here, to not do this, to not make this meeting, to not respond quickly to certain phone calls or to emails. I need to give myself space to grieve. And I think in our culture, people just are not, we're not very great at this grieving process of the time that it takes.
Oh, and of so recognizing, much I want to say on this.
You know, recognizing that people need time.
I totally agree with you. Our culture, and I think even within the church culture, pardon me, as a society, when people used to lose someone, they wore a black armband,
they wore black.
Or they wore black clothing, or they draped their house with black bunting. I mean, there were visible external signs that somebody was in grief or in mourning. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to question it. You didn't even have to, are they in grief? Because they approached you and a man was wearing a black armband, a woman is in a black dress or a black veil, or their house has this. And so you knew that people were in mourning, and it was prescribed about how long that period was supposed to last. And, you know, of course, there's some ways in which I'm glad we don't do that. But on the other hand, it's left us clueless as to how to grieve, what's the pathway, how do we help our friends, how do we go through grief ourselves. And you said one of the most important things, Crystal, when you said it takes time and it takes so much time. And when you lose a child, I can tell you that I am not the same person. Mm. Rick and I are not the same people. Who we were on April 4th, 2013 are not the people we became on April 5th, 2013. Mm. And Rick and Kay, that old Rick and Kay, they're gone and they're never coming back. We have been changed by the loss of our child. We have been changed by the loss of our child to suicide, to that traumatic, catastrophic loss. And when people experience, it's not that grief has different degrees, like, oh, my grief is worse than your grief, or your grief is worse than mine. It's not that. It's just different types of grief have different types of layers. For instance, when my dad died of cancer when he was 85, after a really fulfilling, good life. My dad had the life that he wanted. Yes, there were disappointments, but he had a good life. And when he died, I cried, I wept, I miss my daddy. It's been 11 years and I miss my daddy. When my son died by his own hand, the trauma that was layered on top of loss, the trauma of losing a child, which is some people, other moms who've lost children say it's like losing an arm. Can you live without a limb? Yes. Yes, you can live without that limb, but do you miss it every day of your life? Yes. And so when my son, who died at 27, not 85, when he died by suicide, not peacefully in his bed surrounded by his family after living his natural lifetime, there are layers that get added to it. So if someone you love is murdered, someone you love dies by suicide, someone dies in a violent car crash, when there's trauma, in addition to the loss, it just makes it that much harder to recover,
there's
to
more
heal,
to process.
to move through the grief process. Mm-hmm. And that's something that most people don't understand. But those of us who have experienced those kinds of catastrophic losses, there's something that we get about each other. And I'm glad that most people don't lose loved ones catastrophically. I'm so grateful. I would not wish this kind of pain on anybody. And so for those who have not gone through it, it's not unusual to have people come up to me and say, oh, I really understand what you're going through. My aunt died last year. And I just, you know, outwardly you say, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. And inwardly I'm screaming.
It's not the same.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Or people will say, I lost my dog. And I want to smack them. I'm sorry. There's this part of me that wants to go, you don't get it. You don't know what this loss is like. I understand you have lost something, someone that's precious to you, but there are layers that come with catastrophic grief. So I probably say it takes time, and it takes more time than any of us would ever care to think about. And if we knew it, we would just go, I can't do it, because that's, you're telling me that my life has changed. And if you lose a child, your life has changed. Yeah. And parts of you will never be the same until again you meet your loved one with Jesus when he comes to meet us. I would also say that people want us to move on. People in grief, they want us to move on. And there just is no such thing. You can move on because it wasn't your loss. What I can do is move through it. Mm-hmm. I can move through it, trusting that God is still working in the shattered places of my soul and of the grief that threatens to consume me. I've discovered that there are cemetery people and there are non-cemetery people. I'm a cemetery person. Who knew? I didn't know I was a cemetery person. And that's not something that most of us know about ourselves. Yeah. But for me, going to the cemetery has been part of my healing, part of my processing my loss. It makes Matthew's death real. I can't pretend that he's coming back, because I'm sitting on his grave looking at the gravestone that says in black and white the date of his birth and the date of his death. And that, as painful as that is, that has been helpful for me to accept the loss and to be able to pour my heart out to God. And I've talked to a lot of other grieving moms, and sometimes we're in kind of a small area, so we're all at the same cemetery.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, yeah, well, I'm over here. Well, I'm over here. And I see grieving moms all the time sitting at the cemetery. But there are other people that is like, they can't do that. Mm. They just can't. It's too harsh. It's too traumatic to them to be there. And I've just learned, great, you do what you can do. The other thing, Crystal, that I would say, if I had to sum up something that I would say to people in grief, is when you can, you will.
Wow.
When you can, you will. whatever that is. Yeah. If it's like I used to sit on the front row of church. I'm a pastor's wife. I've sat on the front row to encourage my husband for 42 years. Wow. He was a youth pastor when we got married. Now he's a senior pastor. That's where I sit. That's where I want to sit.
Yeah.
That's where I like, that way I can give him the evil eye when he says something he shouldn't say, you know? But it's where I sit. And after Matthew died, it's like, I can't do that. I can't be that public. I can't sit up here where everybody can watch me and evaluate me. And I know everybody's looking at me. And suddenly that was too much. It took a year and a half, almost 2 years before I could move back to the front row. But when I did, it was at my time.
Yeah.
It was when I was ready. And that's a principle of grief. When you can, you will. Like some people don't put up Christmas decorations. You know, maybe the year that their loved one passes away. It's just like celebrating Christmas is too...
It's too much.
Too many memories. It's too hard. It's too joyful. And they're feeling such sadness. And some people, it takes years before they do. For me, I did the first year because I have grandkids and I didn't want them to lose any more than they'd already lost. But I did it when I could.
Yeah.
So if we can just give people the grace and let them know when you can, you will.
I love
that. And that gives us hope that we can try things that we couldn't do at first, that there are things that we might not be able to do for a while, but then after a while, we do try it. We go, oh, I could do this. Mm-hmm. I could do this again. And it makes you feel so good to have that hope that you are going to heal and you're going to find your way again.
Yeah. It just takes time. It just takes time. So in your She's Still There story, has it been getting back to Kay or has it been finding the new Kay?
No. It's finding the new person that I am. And one of the books that I read that I loved that was so helpful to me is called A Grace Disguised by Jerry Sitzer. And he lost his wife, his mother, and his 4-year-old daughter in a car accident. And so Jerry experienced catastrophic loss.
Yeah.
And I could listen to him because he experienced catastrophic loss. And one of the things that he says is life will never be the same again. No, he says life will never be the same, but it will be good again. Mm. And that's one of those things that I am finding. So when I use the word heal, I don't mean heal as in it never happened. I'm great. Everything's fine. No, it's life will never be the same, but I am finding that it can be good again. And that's what I'm calling healing.
Wow. I love that because it speaks to the idea that life goes on and life is different. But like you said, it can be good. And sometimes I think we expect that as we move forward, that things have to be the same to be good, and they don't. I'm curious to know if you were to compare the old Kay and the new Kay, what would you say is different? How are you different? What do you notice about yourself?
It's funny. I don't have patience. I have both more patience and less patience. So I have less patience with pettiness, with people saying, well, I can't reconcile that relationship, or I can't be friends with her anymore, or I can't, that's just asking too much of me. I don't have as much patience with that because I want to say, listen, life is so short. Mm. Life is so brief. You don't have time to close your heart off like that. Mm. You don't have time to live with at arm's distance from people over petty things. It's just life's too sweet, too short, too temporary to hold people at arm's distance over stuff that doesn't matter, really. Mm. So I'm less patient with that. I think I say more often than not when people will say, well, this just really hurt me that somebody else did or said. And I'm like, yeah, I hear you. Yeah, no, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about that?
Yeah,
I hear you. And or I'll say, you know what? I hear that. At the end of the day, you are a believer in Jesus Christ. And a follower of Jesus Christ doesn't get to do that. Mm. A follower of Jesus Christ doesn't get to shut the door like that in people's faces. A follower of Jesus Christ doesn't get to say, well, it's just too hard to fix that. Sorry, you don't get to as a follower of Jesus Christ. So I'm less patient in some ways, and I'm infinitely more patient with the suffering, the silent suffering, the hidden suffering, the fact that we all, you know, I was saying at the beginning that we used to have these external signs that we were in grief or mourning or carrying a heavy load of the grief, and we would wear armbands or our clothes or, you know, something about us was external and people knew that we were hurting. And what if we could walk through life? Walk through the grocery store today and look for use your imagination and picture every single person in that store wearing an armband. This person's wearing an armband that says, she lost a child.
Yeah.
That guy, he's wearing an armband that said that he has just lost his job and he feels like the biggest failure and he feels like the biggest, he has let his family down and he is thinking he might not be able, that maybe his family would be better off without him. And he's thinking of killing himself because he is so ashamed. Mm. Or walk through the aisle and see that little girl, she's been sexually abused. Mm. And she's wearing an armband that tells you that she's got some hidden trauma. I mean, what if we really imagined that everybody we encounter today is wearing an armband that tells of a hurt or a struggle or a loss or a grief? How that would increase our compassion, mm-hmm. how that would change the way that we interact with a sales clerk or a delivery man or a shopper who, you know, grabs the food that we were just reaching for in the aisle. I mean, how would it change us? I'm different. I'm more compassionate because I'm more cognizant of the suffering that every human being is carrying.
I love what you're saying because it reminds me of the Bible in Philippians 3, where it talks about the fellowship of his sufferings and how we get to know God better when we understand the compassion that he has for others. Jesus came, he was God, but he was also man. So he was dealing with everyone in a physical sense, but he was God. So he knew what was under the covers. He knew what was behind the face. He understood what was going on behind what people were actually saying or doing.
That's right.
And, because he was God, he had compassion. And I think when we suffer, it increases our compassion quotient. You know, this also reminds me of about a movie that I saw. I cannot for the life of me remember the name of it, but it was a movie where the actor saw dead people. Nobody else could see them. And he would say, you know, I see dead people.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Sixth Sense.
Yes.
Yeah. Was that Sixth Sense?
It's Sixth Sense. And so when you see what other people can't, it simply changes your vantage point. You know,
and I think that it's changed the way that losing Matthew has, like I said, it's made me less patient, less tolerant of some things and much more patient and tolerant in other areas. It's made me want to call the church to care for people living with mental illness. We haven't historically done a really good job with that. Mm. And I am so excited when I hear Christians saying, oh, mental illness, it's an illness. You know, duh, it's an illness. It's not a character flaw. It's not somebody needs to go confess a bunch of sin. I mean, just to assume that if somebody's depressed or living with anxiety or an eating disorder, something that they just need to go confess sin or attend more Bible studies. This is our bodies are a whole, and things can go wrong in our brains, mm-hmm. and things happen in our experiences that create. I was talking about trauma in children, how that can play out later on in mental illness and grief. To create safe places to grieve. I have some really good friends that are Jewish, and they lost their 10-year-old son to a degenerative muscle illness a few years before Matthew died. And I went with them to temple several times early in their grieving. And part of what I found that was so interesting is in Judaism, there's a pathway that you follow. There's the 7 days of where you sit Shiva with your neighbors or those of us. It's right out of Job. It's right out of those first two chapters of Job where his friends came and sat with him in silence for 7 days. And because they understood that his sorrow was so great, they knew that there were no words to be spoken. And my friends, when I'd go with them to temple, there was a part of the service every single week in which those who were in mourning stand up and they recite the mourner's prayer. And so they have the opportunity to grieve for an entire year
in community, and nobody looks at them and says, what's the matter with you? You're still grieving. Come on, get over it. It's accepted that it's going to take time and that there's a pathway and that you, the beauty of grieving in community. And so I think the church could really learn from that of allowing people. What if we in our services sometimes, you know, once a month maybe said, all of those of you who are experiencing grief right now, please stand, because we want to pray for you and we want to let you know that we are here for you. It's simple things, but it just allows grieving people the opportunity. And you don't have to say, well, it's because of this or because it's, no, you're grieving today. Whatever mm-hmm. the source mm-hmm. of your grieving, please let us, we want you to know your church family is supporting you today in your grief. We want to pray for you.
What has it looked like for you when you gave the quote by the gentleman who lost his mother and his wife and his daughter in the car accident, and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and he said, life will be good again. What has it looked yes. like for you for life to be good again? And for you, and I'm curious if there has been any feeling of hesitation or guilt if life was good. That if you will, is there a, I shouldn't be doing this, or I don't want to, but I'm going to make myself. I mean, just the challenge with you living in a new way, but you living, what does that look like for you to live? What does it look like for you to live and it be good again amidst the struggle of still, you know, still missing your
yeah.
son?
Yeah, such great questions, Crystal. Really, so clear. You understand. You understand, and that makes me feel really good. It makes me feel really close to you as we're talking, because I really hear that you are asking these questions from places that you have already walked and what you've learned. And I'm so glad to be talking to you about this today. I think that early on, and depending on the person, it can actually go over a period of years, the sense of if I laugh, if I have experienced pleasure, if I have fun, that in some way is letting go of my grief. And really, my grief is all I have left for me as a mom. It's been easy to say, holding on to my grief is one of the ways I remember Matthew. And to let go and to experience joy or pleasure or fun or laugh really hard about something or just be silly or, you know, goofy, that's in some way letting go of Matthew. And I think early on in the grief process, most of us struggle with that. I think that's very common. It's really normal. There's nothing. I think everybody in deep grief experiences that a lot. And it is taking. At some point, it is being willing to let yourself feel joy, let yourself feel pleasure, and understand that by doing so, you're actually honoring the person that you've lost. You're saying, for me, it's Matthew was so silly and goofy. In spite of his suffering, in spite of the depression, he just was a goofball, and he made me laugh. And he was just hysterical. He and his brother were just hysterically funny together. And they picked on me so much, but, you know, I was the easy target. Mom was the easy target, but they were always sweet, mm-hmm. but they just, they teased me unmercifully. But to just belly laugh again, or to realize that, I think, you know, in marriage, there's the, when a couple have lost a child, there's even the guilt of experiencing pleasure together and mm-hmm. physical intimacy, because it's like, how can we experience physical intimacy when we've lost a child? Mm-hmm. You know, it's mm-hmm. like there's something wrong here. And yet again, it's so normal. It's so normal to feel that. It's so normal to have that hesitation, that reluctance to let yourself, to feel good again in life. I think just talking to other people who've gone through grief or going through grief to know, oh, I'm not weird. You know, I'm not weird. This is what people in grief do and feel. And it's okay for me to be reluctant. And it's okay for me to also choose to enjoy the sun on my face today. It's okay for me to laugh at that silly movie. It's not letting go of my loved one. It's actually moving through with my loved one. Mm. And that's the way I've just shifted the focus. It's not moving on. It's moving through life with your loved one.
Give me three examples.
I was gonna say that,
give me three examples of how you have of experiences you've had, things you've done, or moments that you remember that were okay. Life is good. What did that look like for you? What were some life is good moments that you can recall?
Well, I'm so fortunate to have my other two kids and their families who live right here. Mm-hmm. You know, they attend Saddleback, and so I just never anticipated that. I thought my kids would marry and move away.
We're done.
It's more just, that's what we did. That's what our parents did. So I assumed that's what my kids did. And they didn't, they stayed. And it's just been the best serendipity from the Lord. And so I have five grandkids. And when Matthew died 4 years ago, the oldest was 10, the youngest was 1. And to just have them in my house, being kids, playing in the pool, you know, wrestling in the pool, bopping each other over the head, fixing lunch for them. I don't know. There are moments, even from the very beginning, in which I could, while my heart, there was the double-edged sword of the knife in my heart saying, Matthew was such a good uncle. They're not going to get to know him. Oh, this is so horrible. This is so sad. So there was that stabbing of the knife, and at the exact same moment being caught up in their silliness, their love, their tenderness, their hugs around my neck, and saying to the Lord, this is so sweet. This is so sweet. And choosing to let my heart feel the sweetness with him, at the same time feeling the knife of the bitterness of the loss. That's one way. And then another way that I mentioned already is just in my relationship with Rick, to choose to be intimate and to enjoy all that intimacy brings, and not letting that be a roadblock, not being overcome by sorrow. I would say one of the ways even that Rick and I have changed, we both cried, I think, every day for the first couple of years. Rick would tell you he still cries almost every day. Not necessarily face on the ground, but there's something.
The tears squeeze out of the corners of your eyes.
they're right there. They're right under the surface. And that can be an impediment to sometimes in couples' relationships, is one of the pair, often the mom, I think, because moms feel such an attachment to their children it's different than a father's attachment to a child. We carry them in our bodies. We birth them. We nurse. I mean, they literally are part of us. And so frequently, I think women, if they're not really cognizant of this, or they don't have people that can tell them real honestly about grief, they can start shutting their husbands out. Emotionally, physically, and the child, the dead child becomes something that stands in the way of them growing together and grieving together. And we decided that we were going to grieve together. Not that we were going to feel what each other felt at the exact moment. We've allowed each other to be different, to have our own unique ways of grieving. But if Rick walks in the room, like he came in the room after he saw one of the Star Wars, one that came out a couple years ago, and he said there was a character that reminded him of Matthew. And he walked in the door and threw himself on the couch and began sobbing. And, you know, I didn't say, oh, honey, you know, it's a movie. Come on. No, I got down on the couch next to him and just held him. And that's us entering grief together. And so I would say that's a very concrete way, particularly for parents, is to not lose their marriage in that process. A third way is, I think, for in me being a person in leadership, that I'm cognizant that people watch me and they are learning how to mourn because we are so visible. We've had the opportunity to model for our congregation how you mourn, how you grieve, how you be honest, how you weep, how you stand in church with tears pouring down your face, not hiding them, not pretending like it's like everything's good, because it's not. It's not. And there are sometimes a particular song or a particular scripture or something that somebody says in worship just opens my heart up and I'm overcome with emotion and grief and sadness. And yet I choose to plant myself there in the congregation and let them see our grief, be a part of my grief, receive comfort from people, and then show them that I trust God, that God is good. He can be trusted. He takes the ruins of our lives and is still working, and you can live. And so those are, I think, maybe three ways that I've tried to be honest about grief, be honest about the changes, be honest about the suffering that has come, and still choose life.
Well, you wrote a book, and you wrote the book before Matthew passed away, Choose Joy, which is so significant because, and, you know, not that God causes bad things to happen all the time or, you know, that things are always his fault, but timing is certainly peculiar sometimes. I had someone say to me, sometimes the way life works is the things we think we know or that we can talk about. It just so happens that the road of our lives will have us look back at something we said, something we did, something that we thought we could explain. And we'll say, is this really true? Is it really true? And I wonder what it has looked like for you to choose joy. You said that book is about how to choose joy when happiness isn't enough. And it almost seems as if the question with the last 4 years of your life is, okay, how to choose joy when you're overcome with grief, and you've done that, and you've done that, and it's been a process, but it's been a whole different perspective on what it looks like to choose joy, I bet.
Yeah, I'm grateful that God had me write that before Matthew died. It would have been a different book that I wrote afterwards, just because I'm different.
Yeah.
And by that, it's not that the things I wrote in Choose Joy are not true. They are more true than they've ever been. But I wrote it from the place of uncertainty. I knew that Matthew was suicidal. I knew that he had strong suicidal ideation. I never knew from day to day if that might be the day that he would take his life. And so to write Choose Joy in the uncertainty of that was quite challenging. But I'm so glad that God had me write it then, because it gave me what I needed to go through Matthew's death. It literally gave me the tools. I had already had to make decisions about how I was going to respond. What if? I got to the place where I became convinced that, and said to people in Choose Joy, if you're going to experience joy, you must choose it in spite of a situation that you can't change, even if your worst nightmare comes true. And in the middle of circumstances you so very much wish were different. And because I determined that before Matthew died, and determined that I was not going to let anything destroy me, then when my worst nightmare came true, and in spite of losing a child to suicide, and in the middle of grief that I thought I could never, ever, I couldn't even breathe, let alone think of living again, I had, on the day that Matthew died, after I wrote the book, I had gotten a necklace that says Choose Joy. And I got it because this is a struggle for me. I've always lived with low level depression myself. I got to the place where it felt like joy was something that other people experienced, but not me. And so those were the things that caused me to write it. So then I got this, just this necklace that said, choose joy. And I wore it all the time because I needed to be reminded of the things that I'd studied and learned. And on the day that Matthew died, it's details that I don't share, but I had a very strong suspicion that he had taken his life, but it was going to be because of threats he had made and things. It was going to be difficult to ascertain that immediately. Mm-hmm. And we had to wait a bit for the police to come. And so Rick and I were standing in his driveway. And I that morning had put on the necklace deliberately. I pulled it out of my jewelry box and put it on. And as we stood in the driveway waiting for confirmation from the police, he was holding me, and I just looked down, realized that I had it on, and kind of held it up to him. And we looked at each other with a kind of knowing, it was wordless, but it said everything. It said, oh my gosh, our son is most likely dead. The worst day of our lives is happening all around us. We've been believers since we were tiny children. Everything we've ever said we believed is going to be tested, and it's going to be tested right here in this driveway today. And will we believe that God can be trusted, that God is good? Will we choose to put our hope and our joy in him in spite of what we think is ahead of us? I mean, these were not things we said. These were just things that we exchanged in our glance between each other. And that's what we chose. We chose in that moment that God's way was the way we were going to go, that he was good, that we would find joy again, that we would live, that we would walk through the loss of our child, and we would not walk away from God.
I think that the linchpin is that word. It's choosing, because I think so many people assume that if you have joy, or if you have faith, or if you experience depth in your walk with God, it's something that other people have that maybe you cannot, because it's not natural to you. And what you're saying is, in the worst case scenario possible, you decided to make the choice. You decided that for yourself. You decided that with your husband. And it was not an easy road, and it was not simple, and it was not quick. And choosing boils down to all these little choices, probably, that you had to make, but you kept doing it. It's not a one-time deal. It's an ongoing, every day, moment by moment, I make these choices. And it's almost like what you said about that same author. He, because of his life circumstances, he basically had earned the right through unfortunate circumstances to speak life to you. And while those the circumstances of you losing your son is nothing you would have ever chosen, it does give you the inherent right to speak life into someone who is listening. And I know it. I'm going to get the emails, and they're going to say, I cried my way through the entire, because she got it. She understands. I'm not alone. I'm not by myself. There's not something wrong with me, because I'm struggling to get out of bed today again. And so I appreciate the honesty and the transparency with which you describe all of these different parts of your journey and the scenery on your road, because it is clearly communicating to me. So I know it's clearly communicating to those who are experiencing deep grief and loss, particularly traumatic loss, that they're not by themselves, but they still have to choose. And no one can do that for them. They still have to choose.